Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You want to know how long the bad economy is going to last? Try 2013. I know, because Ben Bernanke told me so. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today. This one's the 9th of August. Good to have you with us. You know, very nearly lost in all the hoopla about the S&P downgrade the past couple of days has been this item on the Washington, D.C. policy planning calendar. Today, 9 a.m., Federal Reserve Building, Constitution Avenue in Washington. Regularly scheduled meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee. The FOMC handles interest rates and thereby a healthy chunk of what happens in the American economy. And no, nobody really thought the Fed would do anything with interest rates today, and they didn't. But what they did do was pretty remarkable. In the statement that follows every FOMC meeting, they said they're going to keep interest rates low, near zero, that is, at least through mid-2013. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Most economists thought the Federal Reserve would keep interest rates low. Bruce Kassman is chief economist at J.P. Morgan. He says nobody expected to see a timetable.
To be signaling that you're likely to be on hold for about 2 years is a market departure from anything the Fed has done.
That information was supposed to comfort consumers. Phil Swagel teaches public policy at the University of Maryland.
And it means that anyone who's planning investment or planning to borrow or to lend can have a sense that interest rates will remain low over a long horizon.
But it didn't seem to calm the markets today. Investors know that at this point there's not much else the Fed can do. Its toolbox is empty, it's out of ammo, its pantry is bare. You get the idea. Tom Porcelli is chief U.S. economist for RBC Capital Markets. He says Ben Bernanke is still casting about for other options.
But I think the truth is, you know, outside of additional bond purchases, we don't know what else they can actually come up with.
The Fed has purchased more than $1 trillion of bonds through a program called quantitative easing. That happened in two stages, known as QE1 and QE2. But after today's announcement, economists doubted they'll see any more buying, at least not anytime soon. Swagel says three members of the committee voted against today's statement with that mid-2013 date.
And if they disagree with that, well, that means they're a million miles away from wanting to do QE3.
In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Keeping with our theme of newsworthy items getting swallowed up by the downgrade, the housing market hasn't gotten the headlines it probably would have otherwise. S&P cut its ratings for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac yesterday. And not only that, the mortgage companies reported some pretty dismal second quarter results, too. Losses in the billions of dollars and pleas for more government cash. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the real estate story for us today.
The housing market's a mess. Demand is dead. Prices are low. Foreclosures keep coming. The one bright spot? Cheap mortgages. Keith Gumbinger is with HSH.com, which tracks the mortgage industry. He says the downgrade of Fannie and Freddie will change that.
Ultimately, the downgrade to the credit ratings of Fannie and Freddie will mean higher borrowing costs.
Those higher costs, plus worries about the economy, are a real threat to the housing market's recovery. Nicholas Ritsinas is a housing economist at Harvard.
All the talk, all the reports of the downgrade is just going to further undermine consumer confidence. Consumer confidence is going to make people less likely to enter that housing market.
Ritsinas says lower demand for mortgage loans is bad news for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They already lost billions of dollars last quarter and have asked the government for more money. If people take out fewer loans, that means even less revenue for Fannie and Freddie. But do we really care about Fannie and Freddie's state of health?
Yes, we do.
Dan Nigro is a mortgage bond analyst at Warfield Consultants. He says Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac generate about 90% of home loans. We need the housing market to recover, which means we need Fannie and Freddie to thrive.
If we have future housing declines, it's going to impact consumers, their desire and willingness to spend for the future. And so that's why housing is very important. It's the largest single asset for most people.
Lawmakers were talking about unwinding Fannie and Freddie. Nigro says the downgrade means that's not likely to happen for a long time. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
One nice thing about a worldwide recession? usually leads to lower gas prices. Crude oil hit $75 a barrel today on the way down, closed a little bit above that. Also today, both OPEC and the U.S. Energy Department lowered their predictions for oil demand for the rest of the year. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe reports.
Oil trades in its own little world. Things that sway the rest of the stock market, inflation, value of the dollar. Not my problem, says Big Oil. But right now, oil's glued to the gossip like everyone else.
The price of oil is caught up in the same drama that we're seeing in the global financial markets.
Jim Burkhard follows global oil for Cambridge Energy. He says this news is big enough that everyone sways.
The stock market is reacting to concerns about the future course of global economic growth. And the pace of economic growth is the single most important variable that shapes global oil demand.
If we see a global recession, everyone uses less oil. Even the big developing economies slow down. Until the global outlook's clearer, Burkhard says oil and stock prices will ride the same roller coaster. In the meantime, here's a silver lining for those of us on the ground.
We will see gasoline prices come down because of the lower oil prices.
Carl Larry's with Blue Ocean Brokerage. Gas prices already rolled back after yesterday's oil drop. But he says this isn't 2008, when gas went from $4 a gallon to less than $2. Barrel prices for oil aren't likely to stay down long term.
It's very possible we get back to $100 by the end of the year.
Because, he says, the oil market's already adapted to a sluggish economy the past few years. They simply don't have as far to fall this time around. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
You notice what I haven't done yet? I haven't made any mention of or reference to stocks in any way, shape, or form. You want to know why? Because they make you crazy, that's why. We'll have the details when we do the number. Not to get all Reaganomics on you here, but there is a certain trickle-down element to the S&P ratings downgrade. Not just to big companies like Fannie and Freddie that Stacey was talking about a minute ago. S&P says it's also looking into the possibility of adjusting the credit ratings of municipal bonds. It makes sense, since a lot of those bonds are backed by the now AA-plus federal government. But it doesn't do anything to make economic life easier out there for issuers of muni bonds like cities and states. Mayor Michael Bissonnette is the mayor of Chicopee, Massachusetts. Mr. Mayor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about Chicopee, would you?
Chicopee, Massachusetts is the second largest city in western Massachusetts. We're the home of Westover Air Reserve Base, the largest air reserve base in the country. We also make Callaway golf balls here, and we print the Wall Street Journal here. So we have a pretty diverse economy here in Chicopee. And we have a very large residential component as well.
Now, about the credit markets, you are going to, I understand, go out to the markets in September next month, looking to borrow about $25 million for some new projects, right?
Yeah, we have on the drawing board a new police station, a new senior center, but the Standard & Poor's decision, this is not just going to affect borrowing. You'll see impacts on home mortgages, consumer credit. We just broke ground last week on a $4.5 million expansion of a local car dealership, going to create 20 new jobs. But if folks can't get good credit on their car loans, good interest rates, they may not buy those cars, and those jobs may not appear. So there's a lot of concern throughout my constituency right now about this S&P decision.
What are you paying? What are you going to pay when you go to the markets in September with $25 million? What's your interest rate going to be?
Well, the last two times we went out, the short-term and long-term borrowing, but the last two times we went out, we had interest rates on short-term borrowing of under 1%.
Wow.
And we had hoped to go out and get something around 3.5% for these long-term 20- and 30-year notes. Now it looks like we may be pushed up into the 4%, 5%, even 6%. It's very disconcerting to not have any certainty about where we're going to be when we go out to borrow.
Yeah, well, let me ask you the question, though. I mean, if you wind up having to pay 4%, 4.5%, 5%, and we should say that that's not where the markets are now, but who knows what's going to happen, would you just not build a new police station and senior center?
There may be a point where we say we cannot afford to do this right now, and we'll put it off until the interest rates come down. I'm on my way now to Bridgeport, Connecticut to talk to eight of my fellow mayors about this. In the history of the country, we've never defaulted, and we've never had this kind of partisan turmoil. And I think the partisan bickering is what's got us into this mess, and the partisan bickering is not going to get us out of it. They've got to lower their voices, raise their heads, and look each other in the eye and see if they can come to some common ground.
Michael Bissonnette is the mayor of Chicopee, Massachusetts, out in the western part of that state. Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time, sir.
Thank you so very much. Have a great day.
More than 16,000 police officers are out on the streets of London today. Prime Minister David Cameron sent them out to fight the biggest protests England's seen in a generation. Three nights of rioting, as you've probably seen on television, have left scores of shops and homes ransacked and looted or burned to the ground. The trouble has spread to a half a dozen other big cities as well, fueled, some say, by rising unemployment and public spending cuts. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The spark was the fatal shooting of a young black man by police in North London last week. A protest march over the death degenerated into violence and then turned into an orgy of destruction and looting by black and white youths. Clothes shop owner Liz Pilgrim is one of the many victims of theft and vandalism.
The shop's been turned upside down, the till's been taken out. We're all absolutely devastated. I just can't believe the mindless, wanton violence that took place last night.
Across Britain, tens of millions of dollars worth of property has been damaged or stolen. Ken Livingston, former mayor of London, believes the riots reflect rising youth unemployment, partly caused by cuts in public spending.
The last time we had rioting consistently like this was in the early 1980s when we were in the depths of a recession. It's come back.
But David Frost of the British Chambers of Commerce says the looting was driven by greed and could lead to lasting damage to the communities in which the looters live.
It's business that's at the very heart of successful communities. It's local businesses that create jobs for local people. And so the violence that we've seen over the last three nights, it's destroying the very fabric of society.
And there's another worry. Burnt out cars, wrecked shops and buildings on fire. Not the image this city would like to project as it prepares to host next year's Olympic Games. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, Detroit's problems by way of Sweden.
Ford gave Volvo freedom to find their own way. That is not the same with Saab.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, that's a little number we like to call the sad happy music, because really after the drubbing we've been taking, 429 points up on the Dow today ain't nothing. Blue chips closed at 11,239. That's a 4% gain. The NASDAQ took its own wild ride, eventually pushed up 5.25%, 124 points, 2482 at the bell. The S&P 500 jumped 4.75%, 53 points, 1172 at the bell. Financial stocks led the rally after a 20% dive yesterday. Bank of America took back nearly 17% today. Citigroup regained more than 13%. Google up 5%. Microsoft added 4.5%. Those downgraded U.S. Treasuries, yeah, they rose again, pushed down the yield on the 10-year T-note to 2.27%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases second quarter metro home prices. The Asian American Journalists Association kicks off its annual national conference in Detroit. And, are you a fan of the King? Put on your blue suede shoes and head to Memphis for the first day of Elvis Week. I'm Catherine Roberts.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is, I'll readily admit, pretty far into the program to be talking about a major strike. But a walkout against Verizon has been going on for 3 days now, largely overshadowed, though, by, shall we say, other developments in the economy. Here are the details. 45,000 workers in Verizon's wireline division walked off the job on Sunday. Verizon provides traditional telephone lines in the northeastern part of the country, from Massachusetts down to Virginia. It also delivers high-speed internet and fiber-optic television services. But therein lies the catch, because the non-union and much more profitable wireless division isn't affected by the strike. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Analysts say Verizon's labor unions seem to have missed this call.
Can you hear me now? Good. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
While Verizon's wireless business is booming, its landline network has been shrinking about 8% a year. The company argues those call center workers and technicians can't expect to make up to $91,000 a year, with benefits averaging $50,000. The unions say the company wants $20,000 in pension and health care givebacks. Frank Louthan follows Verizon for Raymond James.
It's just not the profit center that it used to be. It just is not going to be able to sustain the cost structure that it had when they had 30 or 40% more customers.
The union points out the company made $3 billion in the first 6 months of 2011, and the CEO makes tens of millions. But at Recon Analytics, Roger Entner says most of those earnings didn't come from the landline business.
Should the wireless part, which is only a little bit more than half owned by Verizon, subsidize the wireline part?
Paul Secunda is a law professor at Marquette University. He counseled Verizon during its last strike in 2000. This time around, he says the company seems to be arguing that given the bad economy, employees should be happy with what they can get. But he says struggling workers have a compelling case of their own.
I think the best argument that the union has is, look, we're fighting for the middle class. If we can't have these jobs, if these types of jobs are not possible, then no one else is going to get these jobs either, and there's going to be increasing income inequality.
Either way, D.A. Davidson analyst Donna Jagers says the union finds itself in a tough position. Strikers aren't likely to find other work, and the company actually saved money in the early weeks of previous strikes. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Swedish automaker Saab is in no small amount of trouble. Last Friday, the company narrowly dodged having to file a bankruptcy petition. But it's unclear how long Saab's going to last. In any case, assembly lines have been shut down since April. And that, as it turns out, is making some people in Detroit a little bit happy. Big American car makers began selling off their Swedish brands a couple of years ago. General Motors did away with Saab. Ford washed its hands of Volvo. So Christopher Worth went to see how the Swedish auto business is getting along without us.
I'm in Gothenburg, where Magnus Prehm, a production manager at Volvo, is showing me around the company's sprawling auto factory.
So we'll take you through the plant and we will start at the end, start a line.
But as we squeeze past a set of control panels, he warns me not to touch anything.
That shouldn't be good if you and me stop the line right now.
We laugh, but he's not joking. Last year, Ford sold Volvo to Geely, a Chinese car maker that plans to more than double sales to 800,000 vehicles over the next decade. And to keep pace, Prehm says his workers need to receive one car every minute.
We are running at the speed of approximately 800 cars a day.
Now, contrast Volvo with my tour of Saab's factory about 50 miles away in the city of Trollhättan. Gunnar Brunius, a vice president at Saab, walks me through a dark and silent plant, with cars sitting half-made on the assembly line.
In the position where we are right now, we are not running production lines, and we are in a very fairly tough situation.
Just over a year ago, General Motors sold Saab to a tiny Dutch car maker named Spyker, but the company ran out of money to pay its suppliers and employees, and in April, work at the factory shut down. So how did these two iconic Swedish car makers end up in such different positions?
Ford gave Volvo freedom to find their own way. That is not the same with Saab.
Hans Niemann is with Automotive Sweden, which tracks the auto industry. He says it all goes back to the fact that Ford continued to invest in Volvo, developing stylish new models and the kind of innovative safety features Volvo is known for. General Motors stopped investing in Saab as a premium brand. Eventually, he says it was simply mounting Saab car bodies on the same chassis used on any other GM models.
So a bit of the Saab soul was lost on that journey.
Despite the company's troubles, Saab's Gunnar Brunius is still optimistic. After all, he notes, Saab has a very loyal fan club.
We have 11,000 orders on hand, as has to be produced, and I think that is really something is amazing. I mean, the orders is still coming into the factory every day.
Saab says it's on track to secure $350 million from Chinese investors so it can turn the lights back on and fill those orders. The deal is awaiting approval from the Chinese government and the European Investment Bank, which rejected a Russian investor last month. Howard Wielden is an analyst at BGC Partners. He says if Saab does manage to survive, it's going to need a makeover.
The one thing that Saab has that nobody else has is the name, but it doesn't have a future with the cars that it's making. They've got to say, right, we're going to create a new Saab.
But he says that will take money, money that so far Saab is struggling to find. The company had been hoping to resume work at the factory this week. Now it says that won't happen until the end of the month. In Sweden, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner. He is the co-author of the books and the blog and the podcast of the same name. It is, of course, The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Kai. I thought we'd start things off today by playing some tape, some very confident tape. Now, for all I know, some of this may have come from your own radio program.
All right.
The experts on Wall Street are falling all over themselves to predict the year ahead.
Rising inflation and rates will send the U.S. in a downward spiral.
Higher interest rates are going to hurt the housing market.
They're going to make money over time.
Amazon.
Cisco.
Pfizer.
I would bet on it.
Healthcare mutual funds.
General Motors.
Even good old IBM.
Don't hit the sell button just yet.
Oh, my. I don't even know what that was. I can tell you, though, none of it came from my radio program. But anyway, go ahead.
I would bet on it, they say, yeah. Right? So this is about prediction, right? And it's okay. Not just about the economy. We human beings, we like to predict the future just about everything. My Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt, he has a theory as to why.
When there are big rewards to people who make predictions and get them right, and there's zero punishment for people who make bad predictions because they're immediately forgotten, then economists would predict. That's a recipe for getting people to make predictions over and over.
I know what this is. I know what this is. This is, I'm going to channel Stephen Levitt here. This is incentives mattering, right? If you pay people to make predictions, they'll, you know, there's no downside. They'll just predict.
That is exactly right. And here's the big problem. Now, that would be harmless if we weren't so bad at predicting the future. That's the problem here. So if you look at academic study one after the next, it turns out that even experts are only nominally better than a coin flip. But there is a massive demand for prediction and thus arises a big supply. So let's look at this week, for example. On Thursday this week, The U.S. Department of Agriculture will release a very closely watched crop yield forecast. Here's Joe Prasaki from the USDA's Statistics Division.
People get stressed out about it because it's the first one of the season. And it's like, okay, is everything in place? Do we make any changes? You know, are the computer systems all working?
And I'm going to guess that the markets watch this one pretty closely just because it's the first one, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the stakes are high. You know, the markets care about corn and soybeans and things like that. So the USDA will send a small army of enumerators, human beings, out into the fields to check on the progress of crops. Here's Phil Friedrichs, who's been slogging through the cornfields in northeast Kansas.
I go out there and I measure the fields. I go out there and I talk face to face to the farmers, and we collect information from the farmers. What I collect is hard evidence.
Yeah, well, okay, so how hard is this, though, right? I mean, you go out there, you count it up, you get a calculator, boom, you're done. I can do that, and I'm a history political science guy.
You would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, unlike financial predictions or political predictions, you don't have to factor in human psychology. But with agriculture, you've got a little thing they like to call the weather. Now, last year, after the USDA put out its August crop forecast, a spell of hot, dry weather totally messed up that forecast. The corn yield almost immediately had to be revised downward by nearly 7%.
So Goldman Sachs misses earnings by 7%, it's the end of the world, right? So what happens when the USDA misses by 7%?
Well, they're not really held to blame, but It is a big deal in the markets. You know, it depends what side of the trade you're on, of course, but some folks get very, very unhappy. They rely on these forecasts. Joe Prasaki at the USDA, he read me some of the emails he got after this forecast was revised.
Okay, the first one is, this was, thanks a lot for collapsing the grain market today with your stupid, and this is the word is three letters, begins with an A, and then it has $2 signs.
Oh, hey, we can't, no, this is a family radio show. We can't put that on the radio, A with $2 signs.
We did.
We just did, yeah.
But, you know, here's the thing. Joe Prasaki, personally, he doesn't get punished if his forecasts are off. His performance reviews at an agency like the USDA are based on whether the report goes out on time, not how accurate it turns out to be. Mm. And that's really pretty typical. We don't really punish bad predictions. But We here at Freakonomics Radio did some digging, and we found someone who's trying to add a little bit of accountability, finally, to the prediction industry. Here's a reporter named Vlad Mixich, who tells us that in Romania, believe it or not, a senator has proposed a law to regulate fortune tellers.
So if you are one of my clients and if I'm a fortune teller, if I fail to predict your future, I would pay quite substantial fine. Or if this happens many times, I will even go to jail.
I actually love that. I think that's fabulous.
You gotta love it, don't you? I mean, you know, my first thought, of course, is that if fortune tellers are going to be held accountable, for goodness sake, why aren't market analysts and political pundits, maybe even, hey, radio show hosts.
Yeah, hey, you are not welcome here anymore. Stephen Dubner, freakonomicsradio.com is the website. I predict you might be back, although I can't guarantee that.
Uh-oh. I'll bring some corn on the cob if I am.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, there was a brief rip in the economic space-time continuum today. Don't know if you felt it. Long about midday, Apple shares had picked up enough ground to make it the most valuable publicly traded company in the country, worth $347 billion at the close. It briefly bumped Exxon out of the top spot, but by the bell, order had been restored. Exxon was back on top, a billion ahead, $348 billion in market cap there. But the way things are going, one never does know. What's Mars going to bring, does one? All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow soared and then sank and then soared again, ended up 4%, 429 points. The NASDAQ followed suit, pushed up 5.25%, 124 points. The S&P 500 jumped 4.75%, 53 points on that particular index. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up tomorrow, more coverage of whatever it is that's going on in the economy. Downgrade, the Fed decision, the markets, you name it. Also, why Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas wants kids to study science.
Geniuses are recession-proof.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I got a feeling. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.